Hello, welcome to Converging Dialogues. This is Xavier Bonilla. On this episode, I am very happy to bring the conversation I had with Seema Samar. Seema is a human rights advocate. She is also a well-known figure for women's rights as well. She is a Nobel Peace Prize nominee back in 2009. She is a medical doctor. She had received her MD from Kabul University Medical College. And since 2002, she has been the chairperson of the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission. She's also the chairperson of the Commission for the Prevention of Torture. She, prior to the chair of AIHRC, she was the vice president of Afghanistan and their interim administration and the first minister of women's affairs. She has served as a member of the United Nations Secretary General's High Level Advisory Board on Mediation and been a member of the High Level Panel for Internal Displacement. She also has an NGO, Shuhada Organization, which operates 55 middle and high schools for girls and boys in Afghanistan, and three schools in Quetta, Pakistan for Afghan refugees. They do fantastic work. She is, in so many ways, a modern-day hero for a lot of people. She is a giant of a person for all the things she's done for women's rights around the world, and especially in her home country of Afghanistan. She's also been very, very considerate for human rights. She really is just a remarkable woman. So I was very, very privileged and honored to talk with her. She has a memoir that is out, and we talk all about that memoir. We talk about why she wanted to write her memoir. We talk about the history of modern Afghanistan. We talk about the impact of Islam and the role of the Taliban. We talk about her work in medicine and human rights advocacy, women's rights in Afghanistan. We talk about how she became vice president, one of the vice presidents of Afghanistan in that interim government. We also talk about her being the first minister of women's affairs of Afghanistan. We talk about her work on the Human Rights Commission, being nominated for Nobel Peace Prize in 2009, what that was like, women's rights around the world, the future of Afghanistan, and many other topics. Again, it was just a marvel to listen to her story, to listen to the work she's done, how much she's still fighting for women's rights and human rights at large. Again, as I mentioned, her memoir, which is called Outspoken, My Fight for Freedom and Human Rights in Afghanistan with Sally Armstrong, is just superb. I highly recommend it, and that people support her and her work that she continues to do. As always, you can find this conversation and all other conversations at convergingdialogues.substack.com. I'm also on YouTube, so get over there, follow, subscribe, like, share with your friends, contribute if you feel so inclined, support Seema's work, and now I bring you Seema Samar. I am here with Seema Samar. Seema, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. It's a big honor, big privilege. So I'm very happy to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be in your program. Thank you.
Yes, yes. You're very, very kind for giving your time and your energy. So we'll talk all about your new book, your memoir. It is called Outspoken, My Fight for Freedom and Human Rights in Afghanistan. This is with Sally Armstrong as well. But this is your memoir, and we're going to talk all about it. You have a pretty spectacular life. So before we do, obviously we'll talk a lot about your life, but just give us the kind of snapshot of yourself professionally or academically. Just kind of how do you see yourself? How do you usually claim yourself in some ways in the world, and what you're currently doing?
Yeah. I'm a medical doctor by profession, so I was working on health sector, running hospital for the Afghan refugee in Pakistan, and also building hospitals in Afghanistan, and also schools for the young generation of Afghanistan, for the boys and for the girls. And I do believe that education is key to empowerment, and education is key to to build the self-confidence of any human being to be a good citizen for not only for a specific country, but for the whole world. And I then I was involved in politics, and I'm a human rights defender, and I really fought hard in order to promote human rights and equality in Afghanistan and also in other parts of the world if I can. But of course, the main focus was in Afghanistan. And I'm also a strong advocate for accountability and justice in any country, but because I do believe that injustice in one country is fueling the culture of impunity in another countries. So that is what I am. And currently I'm visiting scholar at Fletcher School at Tufts University.
That's wonderful. As people will see, you have a life truly dedicated to service for others. And so it'll be very nice to remark on some of your themes of your life. So I guess the question here is you start out, by saying that you're, physician, medical doctor, you're a human rights advocate, you've been some time in politics, all of these things. I guess the question I have is for yourself at this point, how do you, when you look back on your life, and we'll talk about major themes on the global stage and for you personally, how do you kind of see your life? How do you see yourself? Yes, these are the titles, but how do you see yourself and what you've contributed to the world? And I guess more specifically, why did you decide to write it all down for everyone else to read about? So you're kind of two things, how you see yourself and why you decided to write it down.
I think I see myself as a, as I said, as a human rights defender, and I'm glad that I was able to do to promote and protect human rights in Afghanistan, which is not an easy country. And particularly, as you see always in the media, that Afghanistan is the worst country for women. It has been a bad country, but imagine now that practically women in Afghanistan under the house arrest. So the other point that I would say that my impact was, I'm not saying that I had a really big impact, but I would say that the facilitation for people's access to education to and also to health is something that I give me a confidence that, okay, my life was worth it or my suffering was worth it. Because I walk, for example, I walk in the airport, a young boy or a young girl comes up and say that, can I take your bag because I gone to the school that you started, or I born in your hospital. So things like that give me courage to continue.
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah, I think that has to feel like such an overwhelming sense of gratitude to the world and gratitude to people that have been impacted. I mean, that's really, really incredible. So we'll talk about some of the current stuff with Afghanistan. Of course, it has such an interesting history in modern times. Obviously, there's been U.S. involvement there as well. Currently, it's in a tough shape. So I'm sure we'll mention that. Maybe just tell listeners. So I haven't talked too much about Afghanistan formally or properly on the podcast. So there's no better person than yourself probably to discuss Afghanistan, which is a wonderful country in many ways from what I hear, naturally and its people. Give us the kind of backdrop for Afghanistan. Again, many conflicts and issues, but there's a lot of other things to this part of the world. In the book, you talk about these four major ethnic groups, Pashtuns, Tajiks, Hazaras, and Uzbeks in the country. And there's some important complexities there. So yeah, just kind of tell us about your country and some of these major people groups and some of those complexities.
Yeah, I think Afghanistan geographical location is in the middle of Asia. And that makes Afghanistan actually it can be used if you use Afghanistan in a positive way. It can be a connector between the different country. But if you see the other side, I mean, Afghanistan can be a wall between the different powers. The other day I was talking with my son and also with some other people about the history of Afghanistan, that how civilized people were and how some of the, like Buddhism went to China from Afghanistan, or the whole Silk Road, that all the traveling all the way to Saudi and Egypt and I don't know, to Europe, was through Afghanistan. Yeah. And what is what we are today? And I think the recent history that I have been witness when I was, let's say, young, when the Russian, the coup d'etat was happened in Afghanistan, and then the Russian invaded Afghanistan, and watched that how the people, it was not very advanced country, it was not very developed country, and it was not very modern country or democratic country, but people relatively were living in peace. Peace in terms of not the holistic definition of peace. But yeah, I mean, at least it was kind of stability. And everything was gone after the invasion of the Russian and the coup d'etat by the pro-Russian a year before in 1978. And then when they started to restrict people's human rights and freedom. And people start to resist against them. And the people, of course, they started to resist against the regime with stick and stone, not really with advanced American Kalashnikovs or guns or so on. And how Afghanistan was used to block the USSR advancement, and their religion was used as a weapon of war. And how the extremist and fundamentalism was begun. And the impact of that kind of a policy, not only in Afghanistan, extreme groups like Boko Haram or Al-Shabaab and everything. The beginning was, in my view, maybe I'm wrong, but I see it that it's grown from Afghanistan, unfortunately. Of course, USSR collapsed, but we are still stuck in that same policy. Now, if you look at the resolution of the Security Council in the UN, it's always the other bloc veto the stronger resolution in Afghanistan. And it's strange because the one who fought against the USSR, now it's their friend.
No, it's very strange.
It's very sad because I keep saying that the Afghans were not born so extremist and so violent. The overall political dynamic in the region and also the game of the superpower made us as we are now today.
Tell me about this a little bit. Many people will know, we'll get to it in a bit, but we'll know this story of Afghanistan, you know, post 9/11, the Taliban, the whole thing. And we still see that today, unfortunately. But what was it like in Afghanistan, you know, pre 78, you know, in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s? Like how was it different? You said that there was a, you know, it, humble in some ways. Maybe there was some poverty, of course, but there was a kind of simplicity there. There was a sort of equality. What was it like to be in Afghanistan and you know, kind of the years or decades before, you know, 78?
Yeah, I think it was, as I said, that it was poor country, and they started to establish some schools, and particularly for the girls' schools, as it was limited to the cities. But they just before the coup d'etat and the Russian invasion, they started small primary schools in most of the villages and districts, part of the different village and several districts, and all of the districts of the country. And with the coup d'etat and the beginning of the war, those small schools which was started was destroyed. And of course, it was a patriarchal society, but I cannot really compare the 60s that I lived in today. The situation. I gone to co-education school in Helmand. Helmand is one of the very conservative province of the country. And we had the school uniform as a socks and a skirt and a small white scarf, and nobody was harassing us. I mean, the people from the region, they didn't send a lot of their daughters to school because we didn't have, as I said, that we didn't have a lot of schools. But the one who had access, or the one who were living simple shopkeepers or farmers, they were not like looking really in a negative way to us as a young girls going to school with Western clothes. But this is not the case today. I mean, we see, they have to be fully covered. The number of the burqa that we see today in Afghanistan, I never saw it, particularly in the different districts. In Helmand, it was only the wife of the official wearing burqa was kind of a luxury. It was the distinguish. It did distinguish between the women living in the cities or some of government's service peoples and families than the original people. The original local people were not wearing the burqa. They didn't even knew the burqa, because currently it's become the our uniform, actually.
Yeah. Tell me about this. Maybe you can tell me about the four major ethnic groups, but also the role of Islam. So I think sometimes people will see, you know, here in the West, a kind of very, you know, we see the extremism or the very, you know, pretty, you know, severe forms of fundamentalism of this religion, which are, you know, have negative impacts and consequences for sure. But I think there's a way in which many people in the West start to flatten out, you know, all of the Muslim world, and that's unfortunate, because I think it's there's a lot of you know, ways in which to practice the religion, but unfortunately there has been a lot of extremism there. I guess tell us about the impact of the religion and different variants or different sects of the religion, and how this does or doesn't contribute to some of the ethnic groups that are there that may also have different religions. Talk about that kind of those variables and that dynamic.
Yeah, I think, as I said, that it was, as you already mentioned, also that we have different ethnic groups in Afghanistan: the Pashtuns, the Tajiks, the Hazaras, the Uzbeks, and there's a lot of other small minority groups in the country. But the majority of the people are Muslim. Within the Islam, then the majority are Sunnis. But there is a good number, maybe 25 to, nobody did the exact calculation, but maybe between 25% to 28% are Shias. But as we say, as a Muslim, we say that there's no problem in Islam, but there's a problem on our practice. How do we practice? Because in my personal view, it's the religion is your personal choice between you and the God that you believe. I think there's no sentence or no proper interpretation of Islam that you can impose your religion and force people and be violent. Because when we see each other, we say salam. Salam means peace. Right. So it does say a lot of things, that the religion is not violent, but when it become a political tool to oppress people, to control people, then of course it's used by not only by Muslim, but unfortunately a lot of other religion is doing the same things. So you look at India, you look at other countries who use the different religion And there are fundamentalists of all religion, unfortunately, because we as a human being, we always try to be superior than the rest of the people.
Mm. Yeah, it's very interesting how we see fundamentalism or various, you know, strong ideologies take hold in some places. I want to just jump here a little bit to the Taliban, so because we've mentioned it, so I don't want to wait too long to get there, but we can give maybe some of the background of the story. But there was a time when they were there in the country, I think you say in the mid-90s, and then U.S. involvement after 9/11, you know, pushed them out. And you have had some time in politics as well, at a pretty high level, and seeing the kind of way of them there and then not there. And then I just want to ask this question before I forget. We know what happened in 2021, yes. I think is when it was. Where, you know, for those of us here in the US and maybe other places, you know, we're kind of watching on, you know, our screens, whatever we're watching it, of the country, you know, going to back to the Taliban in a weekend. And I mean, quite literally, and the president's on a plane going off to Europe. And we had a pretty terrible withdrawal started by President Trump, you know, continue with President Biden. And I think it was making the deal with the Taliban. And I mean, I know how it looks from a Western perspective. I'm curious for your perspective, especially being so close to these issues there. What does that feel like? You know, I spent 20 years, you know, or, you know, in and around the interim government and the governments afterwards, and then your entire career in life working for human rights, working for women's rights, probably, you know, one of the best people working for women's rights in the world, for education. And it feels it's gone in a week in your own country. You know, women can't go to school. They can't be educated. They're having to wear restrictive clothing. They have basically no rights. But just the speed of how fast, like, why go back to something that is obviously so terrible? You talk about in the book of there was legitimate progress. There was legitimate ways in which people were getting education. They were having better health care. They were having more say in politics and how to do things in society. It just seems so wild to go backwards so many years. What was your experience for you seeing this, and what did that feel like?
It's very, very difficult to explain it in words. Because, the Taliban was in power in 1996, from 1996 to 2001, but they were in Kandahar from 1994. Mm-hmm. At the beginning, they promised that they are going to disarm the different groups, that the militias that they had. That we had in Afghanistan, and they were fighting among each other for controlling the areas, the villages, and the people. And they will bring peace. But as soon as they were taking any city, then the first thing was close the girls' schools, and women cannot work and women cannot walk freely. They have to wear this burqa and so on. And then actually, after the collapse of the USSR and collapse of the pro-USSR regime in Kabul, the US and other countries who were involved supporting the opposition to USSR, they walk away. I mean, they said, okay, it's done. Of course, they achieved their goal, which was the collapse of the USSR. And then the country was isolated, and the different people who fought alongside of Mujahideen, and they already established Al-Qaeda. So I don't know how old you are, but if you remember in 1998, there was attack in Tanzania and Kenya on the U.S. embassies, mm-hmm. and it was claimed that it was done by Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda had their training camps in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then it was during the Clinton, President Clinton administration when they fired missiles in Afghanistan and also in Sudan because they were traveling between Afghanistan, Sudan, and Saudi. Yes, then unfortunately 9/11 was happening. They were not paying attention that they knew that it was training camp. But they were not taking any action because they had, I don't know what was their priority on that time, but and 9/11 was happened. And then suddenly people, Afghanistan on that time turned to be the biggest prison for women and the biggest producer of opium and also the training camps. And then after 9/11, the intervention by US and the later on NATO forces in Afghanistan, I think there were never a long-term policy to promote human rights and promote equality in Afghanistan. Yes, their presence brought some positive outcome in the country, facilitated the access to education. Girls were going to school. Women were in politics. They were, we were in every sector. I mean, they were in sports. They were in media. They were. We never had a female camera woman, as we say, but then we had a lot of female camera who were doing filming and so on. But suddenly, because of the lack of long-term strategy and clear strategy, and one of the problems is that you can plan when to start the war, but you cannot plan when to end. It was, unfortunately, during President Obama administration when they decided that they withdraw in 2014. And in that time, the Taliban said that you have the clock, we have the time. So that was clear that they were planning that, okay, you will withdraw, the troops will withdraw, and we will intensify the war, the attacks. And then it was happened in 2020 when the American began, 2019 when they start to talk with the Taliban, although they were talking before that, I mean, during 2010, they started, but it was not very public. And then officially they start talking and practically the Afghan government was not involved much. And I put it this way that the Afghan leadership, or the President Ghani and his team, didn't have the capacity to manage the whole process. He could have, if he should have, but then on this side, Khalilzad was not really paying much attention to the involvement of the government. And what they were telling to the people after the signing of the agreement between Taliban and the American into 29th February 2020, it was 4 pages of agreement, and there's no word in it. There's no woman, there's no human rights, not a lot of condition. Yeah. The condition that they put, even those conditions, was not applied. And if you look at the Security Council 1325 resolution of women involvement in the peace process and peace building, and all the other, a few other resolution from the Security Council. Immediately after the signing between the American and the Taliban, they unanimously approve, support that peace, so-called peace agreement. And you feel that what's going on? They made the resolution, and then they do not apply the resolution, so whom you can count on. And of course, then publicly in the media, they were saying that we will leave Afghanistan when the condition is right. The Secretary General of NATO, after in the same day, into 29th of February 2020, he came to Kabul with the Defense Secretary of the U.S., and they announced that they will leave when the condition is right. The NATO Secretary General said that we came together, we will live together when the condition is ready. But I don't know if the condition was ready when they gave after 20 years to the same people who were ousted and brought back to power.
I guess the question here is maybe this one might be a dumb question, but why is there you have the Afghan government, the president, cabinet, and the government, and then the Taliban, and then the U.S. Why did they have to deal with the Taliban to begin with? Why couldn't the Afghan government deal with them directly or through an intermediary? Or why was there this kind of direct kind of agreement there? Was it just they're kind of holding, quote unquote, holding things hostage here and saying like, hey, if you don't do an agreement with us, then we're going to start doing all these things? Or why did we have to do that to begin with, I guess?
I don't know what was going on because, of course, all the countries, not only the U.S., all the countries who were involved in Afghanistan, their policy was shifting according to their political environment. You know, the election in different countries has an impact on Afghanistan between the different political right or left parties the parties who are in between right and left. So that was also something that we were, I think it was a mistake because the government that you spend 20 years in supporting and then suddenly you undermine that and give to the Taliban that based on their demand, because the Taliban was saying that we are not talking with the Afghan government, it's a puppet regime, and we are going to talk directly with Americans. Why the Americans should actually endorse that or going to that kind of a deal?
It's quite puzzling in a lot of ways. I know that, you know, the U.S. wanted to be fully out of Afghanistan after a long time. However, it's quite poorly done is a nice way of saying it. I want to come back to some of these themes, but I do want to go backwards a little bit and say about your start in medicine. So you talk about your early life and your upbringing. And you talk about in high school becoming really involved or starting to think about human rights. You talk about your family in the beginning and some of the things that happened there with your husband and your son. How did you come to take an interest in human rights generally as an adolescent? And then, you know, going into, you know, doing medicine and starting your own clinic and serving different people and some of your experiences like the one in Quetta and other places and starting to see women's rights. Just tell us in your youth during this time in the, you know, late 70s or, you know, the 80s when there's a lot of conflict going on with the USSR. How did you really start to not only want to work and serve and speak on, you know, human rights, women's rights, education, but to do it in the way in which you did it, building clinics or hospitals or trying to advocate in that way? People find different ways of doing that. You didn't become a politician. You didn't become an activist necessarily outright. You used medicine. You used a kind of a helping profession, if you will. How did you come with this and decide to your trajectory of doing it in that way?
Yeah, I think that the watching the discrimination within the family, between the boys and girls, and also between within the society because of my ethnicity, because of my religion, because of my gender. Then I started, I was quite young when I started to try to prove that I'm good. So that's why I was working hard at home and also in the school, not to give the reason for my family to take me out of the school or to marry me off, because a lot of girls in my age who didn't go to school, they were already married. So I was trying to be different. And then I continued that because we were quite young, and it was, as you know, that technology was not that advanced, but we were getting all the information from radio and some printed printed paper or magazines about the different politics going on and about the social changes in Afghanistan. Like we were, when we were young, we started to talk about the forced marriage or child marriage of the girls, and the their access to reproductive rights and decision making. So that was the reason that I continued. And then when I, of course, when the USSR, the coup d'etat was happened and USSR came, that was more like, as a young who were involved on these issues, of course it was illegal and it was not a legitimate invasion of the country. And then doing some activities against the USSR at that time, not very, I would say not very, very revolutionary, but we were writing slogans on the wall. We were distributing night letters and talking about the what they claimed, the government. And the, then watching the violation of human rights was really in the country and going through this, this whole lack of accountability and the culture of impunity because they were belong to that political party. And that is, so I continued. And then, of course, I lost my husband. And then it was difficult to struggle as a young woman, as a young mother, to stand on my own feet. So that was that was not easy, but I did it because I was doctor for in the Wazir Akbar Khan Hospital, which was one of the best hospitals in Kabul at that time. Then we realize that how much the regime controls in the Russian or has controlling everything in Afghanistan, including their advisor in that hospital was so bossy and dominating. So then I left for the area which was not under control of the government. So there I saw how people are suffering from lack of access to health. Because I grown up in Helmand and we had a hospital in Lashkargah City. And we didn't face very much the lack of access to health care. We were going to that hospital and it was free of charge. Anytime if you were sick, you could go to the emergency in the middle of the night. If you, during the day, you would go. And that was not the case in the rural area, people. In that district, actually, our own people have not seen any female medical doctor from their own people. So then that was, I stayed there more than 2.5 years. And then I saw that how terrible is the situation. So when I moved to Pakistan, then the camps was also the camp for the refugee, for the Afghan refugee was terrible. So that's why I started to, was thinking that I was hopeful that we will get rid of Russian and then it will be, the country will be back on its feet. I was not expecting, honestly, that the war will be so long. We end up with this kind of regime.
One of the things you talk about in your time in Pakistan and in the more rural areas of Afghanistan is really seeing this degradation of women, destroying an educational system, denying human rights. I mean, these devastating things for Afghanistan in the 80s, and they, I think, have a ripple effect today. We see this with the Taliban. We saw this with, you know, with obviously with USSR. I think it's a legitimate answer, but I think it's an incomplete answer to the nuance of this. The legitimate answer seems to be, well, this is a truly patriarchal system, like legitimately, right? How the treatment of women is there. But in your mind, what's the more nuanced, complicated picture of this? Like, it's not just saying, oh, it's a systemic thing. I mean, of course it is, sure. Why at such great lengths to to not only mistreat women, but to treat them as less than, as completely not equal. We see mistreatment of women all around the world, unfortunately. But there is a difference in how women are treated in some places as opposed to others. And the treatment of women for 50 years in Afghanistan, with some pauses or some breaks in between there, has been, devastating. Why? Why? It's not with children. It's not with older people necessarily. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but why is there such a disdain for an equal treatment of women, or not wanting to see them flourish, or not wanting to see them, be educated and to succeed? Why is there so much of that in the region and in Afghanistan specifically, and has been for many years?
Well, for us, I think it was the conflict and the war, because it was the misuse of religion and misinterpretation of religion, because Islam started with the, according to the Quran and according to our religious belief, that the first message to the Prophet Muhammad was Iqra. It's Arabic, but Iqra means read. So you cannot go, if you don't go to school, you cannot read. So that is clear that, and there's a quote from the Prophet that every Muslim man and woman has to get education, even if it's China. On that time, maybe the distance between China and Saudi Arabia was quite long. With that kind of transportation that was existing. So it is not in the religion. It is the misuse and politicizing of the religion to impose. And I think it's always, not only in Afghanistan, in very advanced country, you could see that how the main in politics and power trying to misuse the rights of women for their political gain, for their political agenda. Even in this country, how they are using women's rights and women's freedom for their political gain. So Afghanistan is also like that. And then in conflict country, any country who's in conflict, and if there is no physical security, always women's rights and freedom are restricted under the name of protection. And it's very common. I see that in Africa. I see it that in Afghanistan. I see it in any conflict country, because the truth and the reality is that our physical body is more vulnerable to violence. And men, usually they use their physical masculinity and control over women. So now, some people are trying to use this excuse, yes, Taliban is the reality of Afghanistan, and people are supporting them. People are not supporting them because they are very violent. So because of their policies and imposition of their mentality, the male member of the family is trying to protect the female member under the not allowing them to get out, pushing them to wear the hijab and the burqa. I think partially it's legitimate, because they do not want them to face violence, and they themselves should not be face violence, because recently when they arrested some of the women in Kabul, focusing in the Hazara area and also in non-Pashtun areas, then they got, and the family member had to sign a paper and guarantee that she will not get out again without burqa. And they paid fine. So this is not in the law, nowhere, but it's applied over there. Because there is lack of accountability, lack of fair trial, lack of rule of law. The only country in the world without constitution and law.
Yeah, that's absolutely tremendously terrible for how that exists. And it just listening to you talk about it is, I guess I'm just so puzzled by, I mean, yes, you're right. I mean, every religion has fundamentalists. Every religion has extremism. But for there to be enough people to bully their way using, you know, misinterpreted or misguided interpretations of a text, to control a whole country is just astonishing to me. It continues to be astonishing. And having all of these, I mean, antiquated again is a nice way of saying it. I mean, it's an inhumane way of treating women, and to justify that and to control a country that way is again, it's just kind of astonishing in some ways, especially in 2024. I want to ask about some of your other work, which you're kind of known for, but I definitely wanted to talk about your medical work, of course. In the 90s, you were starting to gain some traction. You had some involvement with or some interactions with folks from Norway and the U.S. to try and help for building certain clinics and things like that. And you had some recognition talking at the Davos conference in the mid 90s at World Economic Forum. So after 9/11 happens, so you were kind of known in certain places, and after 9/11 happens, U.S. involvement's there, of course, and they wanna put in an interim government with President mm-hmm. Karzai, and you talk about, I was reading the book, it was wild how you found out that you were the I believe first minister of women's mm-hmm. affairs, and also one of, I think, is it four vice presidents of the country with Karzai, again in the interim government, was pretty wild. Could you talk about that experience briefly, about what that was like to find that out and to all of a sudden be thrust into literally the center part of the world stage at that point? Because everyone was looking at Afghanistan and what was going on and the war and all these things. Yeah, just from your perspective, what was that like?
Well, I was advocating for women's inclusion. So we were, when the pro-Russian government collapsed and the Mujahideen went to Afghanistan and they did not include any women and they were violating women's rights. So I was loud mm-hmm. doing advocacy against them and talking in the different conference. And we even had a demonstration in Quetta, Pakistan, a big one against them that they did not include the minorities and also did not include women in their policy. Mm. So when 9/11 was happened, I mean, before that, I was invited to a conference in Germany, Terre des Femmes, they had their 10th anniversary of their establishment. And they asked me to be the keynote speaker in their conference. So that was accidentally, I was supposed to travel the morning after the attack of the Americans on Afghanistan. Mm. So then when I was in Germany, they organized the different city tour in public talks. And it was so much attention because it was really attracted a lot of people. And I was doing 3-4 interviews per day and all the televisions and media. And I was calling for women's inclusion. And then when I went back to Pakistan, I bought a ticket and I went to Islamabad to see the special representative of UN for Afghanistan. He was Francis Vandrell. He died, unfortunately. He was from Spain. And I told him, I said, women should be included in the process, but not. I mean, he's not here, but I told him, not Sima Samad. But it should be women, because then it will be very difficult. So then it was late November 28, 29th of November, there was a conference organized by the World Bank for reconstruction of Afghanistan. So we were all there. I mean, the civil society, the people who were working on NGOs. And then the discussion or the talk in Bonn was already going on. and they were not getting close to an agreement. It was between a different Mujahideen group. So the UNDP said that we are invited, including me, invited to the Bonn conference as a representative of civil society. And I said, well, I'm going to Canada because I was receiving this John Humphrey Award, which John Humphrey is the person who drafted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And so I was interested to get that award in Montreal from Rights and Democracy. So I came to Canada and I didn't go to Bonn. And I simply told to Norwegian, I don't forget to Norwegian journalist, I said, she said, why you are not going? I said, I don't trust that they will come to an agreement. So let them fight between themselves. So I went to Canada and then suddenly it was the announcement made. While I was in Germany, actually, I received a message from the United Nations that Lakhdar Ebrahimi, who was, again, was put by Kofi Annan as special envoy for Afghanistan, on top of the SRSG, the special representative. And they said that Lakhdar Ebrahimi want to meet you in New York. I said, no, I have other program. If he wants to meet me, he can see me in Pakistan. I was not thinking that they will come a conclusion and establish a roadmap for Afghanistan. So I was in Vancouver. We were flying to Edmonton when my son called. My son was a student in Texas, and I think he was partially doing some night shift work. So he called me and said that you become one of the vice president and the minister of women's affairs. That was very interesting. As I wrote in the book, I had to take a hot shower to wake up that what's happening.
Yeah, it's nice how you talk about it in the book, because it also kind of comes like, I think, if people look you up online, they'll see that. But knowing, just hearing how you tell the story, it also kind of surprises the reader of like, that's how it happened. Like just that's how, and that's, it's super, super, super wild. The story, obviously Afghanistan was, lucky to have you there for that time. In the time that you did those things in the interim government, you have this really nice moment with, I don't say nice, but it's an interesting moment, where you talked to Colin Powell, who's now left us, and he, you said, there were four things that you wanted, that you didn't want Afghanistan to be abandoned, you wanted some money on reconstruction, women's empowerment programs, and more females in U.S. embassies. And why did you ask those four things? And over your time in the government at this period, why did you think those things were important, and how to, when trying to do a government or to have a space to do this, why that emphasis?
Well, I think because we saw that the U.S. involvement on supporting the Mujahideen against the USSR, and then the isolation and leaving Afghanistan on its own, and the conflict and the war between the Mujahideen group and the Taliban. So I said that what you did in 1992, please do not repeat it. And I said, he was so, I have to say that he was very, very kind. He listened to me patiently. And then I said that the amount of money that you spend on bombing should be spent on construction or reconstruction of Afghanistan. And we need a job opportunity for young youth Afghan men. And he said, do you know how much money we spend? And I said, no, I guess it's a lot. And thirdly, I said that of course, I said I'm coming from a minority group and I don't have militias. All the other members of the cabinet has their own militias, and my security is also an important thing. And he said he is the first black Secretary of State in the U.S., so he understands me. a non-woman? Yep. He said he will try to send some female. I said, send some female soldier and female diplomat. And he said, he will try. I said, because I want the Afghan people to see, to watch that women also can be in, on those positions and can do the work. Mm. Mm. And
I think it's very important or instructive that you asked, you know, for this at the beginning. I think a lot of people, you know, if someone else was in your place, they may not have asked for that, or, you know, to put women front and center, I think, which is important. You're the founding chair of the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission. And you had the ears of NATO, the UN, various diplomats, the Afghan military. So all of a sudden, you have this huge, you know, human rights commission, which is super important. Human rights, you know, I'm sure you were always very busy. You talk about trying to build an office and just kind of starting from the ground up from scratch. But what was it like to try and build that infrastructure and then to do that work, to have that commission, and to have, yeah, the kind of the ear or the attention of all of these big, powerful people in the world to try and help out? Tell me a little bit about that experience and what that was like.
Yeah, I think when I was running the NGO that I started the hospital and schools, and it was not easy. They were looting, they were blocking. But I resist, so I achieved that part. So in Ministry of Women's Affairs was same. It was, there was no structure, nothing, and not enough support. Yes, everybody was seeing me as a female member of that government, but practically it was not enough support for the Ministry of Women's Affairs. But then I was pushed actually out of the cabinet and being the chairperson of Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission, which I wanted to do because as a Minister of Women's Affairs, I was given the responsibility to begin the establishment of the Human Rights Commission. And we started from scratch. We fought for every single thing. We didn't have enough. And I think I was able to get the support of the public quickly. And it was one of the, let's say, a state institution that the people really trusted. And it was not easy because the powerful people, the militia leaders and so on was against us. And they were really using that, yeah, she's not Muslim. She's promoting the immorality among women and talking about these things. We took very sensitive issues, such as Pachabazi, for example. We criminalized the dancing boy in Afghanistan. It was existing and nobody was taking it seriously that it's a violation of those children's rights in the country. Mm. We also did a national inquiry on honor killing and rape. And honor killing in a lot of those countries happening, in a lot of countries happening. And there were no specific law that criminalizing that because it was counted as a family matter and private matter. We criminalized that. We codified in the law. But yes, it was not easy. But we made a space. I have to say that there were a lot of resistance by powerful people and militia leaders because I was calling for accountability and I was calling for justice on the fringe issues. Mm. I have to say that one thing that we, in my personal view, which played a very negative role and facilitated the collapse in Afghanistan was lack of justice and lack of accountability. The overall impunity, culture of impunity in the country. So that was big, big issue in Afghanistan. And I have to say that we were the leading national institution of human rights in our region. Although India had it before us, but we were much much better than Indians. I mean, India, mainly you only work on the receiving complaints, but we were very white. But they have a lot of other commissions.
How much of this was, you know, you start out and it's, you know, it sounds like you're very proud of this, as you should be. How was this continued throughout the 2000s, 2010s, up until, I don't know if it's still in operation currently. Mm-hmm. I'm going to assume no, unfortunately. But up until it wasn't, I guess until the Taliban was there again a couple of years ago, how much were you able to do? You're listing some of this, but up to the right, to the end, I mean, you have about almost 20 years of work. I mean, that has to be anything that's happening currently or now. I mean, it you know, is how it is, but you must feel very proud of the work you did in 15, 20 years for human rights in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I think I'm proud of that. And I'm proud because I introduced the word human rights in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that it was really flourished, but what we were able to promote the words in every household, even in a very remote part of the country, at least people were discussing. Just to give you an example, there was one day early in 2004 that elderly men came to the office and insist that he wants to see me from one of the village in Ghazni. So he came. I said, okay, let him come. What is happening? And then he said, I came to see you because I have a 5-year-old granddaughter and she's crying that she wants to go to school. And she cannot walk to school because it's almost 1.5 hours for elder girls to walk to reach to the school. And she's crying and she's saying, threatening me that if you don't allow me, I'm going to complain to Simo Samar. So he said, I came to see who you are, that you influence these young girls, that she wants to go to school and threatening me that she will complain to you. And it was really a nice, pleasant moment, I would say. Or once I was traveling from Delhi to Kabul, so the hostess, we were in Air India flight, she was standing there and everybody was passing and saying, greeting me, and conservative Afghans from different ethnic group with their turbans and so on. And then this girl was watching and then finally she came and said, who you are? That the people are so respectful. When I said I'm one of the women in Afghanistan, but I have louder voice, so that's my idea.
There's a true impact, I think, for at the very least a generation or two. For women, and I think just for many people in Afghanistan, you've had a big imprint on, which is not nothing. I mean, that's something that is something we'll live, and hopefully we'll encourage people to, you know, keep doing similar types of things. I want to ask real quick. It must be an interesting moment to know. You were nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 2009. You had some competition. Mm-hmm. This is the year that Barack Obama, the president of the U.S., won that year. So losing to Obama, I guess, for a prize like that is, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but you know, he was something. He did a lot of things. And so what was the experience like, though, just knowing that you were, you know, I think some people have different ideas about these awards or these kind of prizes, but you know, to know that your work was being recognized truly on a global stage in that way, to really recognize that as someone for peace globally, you know, what did that feel like just to kind of be nominated or recognized?
Well, I think it was encouraging because at least it was recognized. And I didn't know that I was candidate. And then suddenly the different journalists came and said that I'm candidate and I've been shortlisted. And then I had a lot of journalists in my office when they announced, of course, they announced that President Obama won the election. And, you know, it's interesting because I was thinking that I am competing with somebody who's the most powerful person in this planet.
Yes.
That was something. When President Obama came to Kabul, there was a dinner, and President Karzai also invited me. But I was not there to mention that I was competing with him. I didn't mention that because I didn't want to be very selfish. But I did say to him that do not forget the woman's role in every policy and every decision making about Afghanistan. And he said, no. In fact, he said, my mother was working on development agency. So I am very much aware of that. And then it was kind of a misinterpreted somehow that President Karzai said that you said, don't forget me. And I said, no, I didn't say don't forget me. I said, don't forget women in this country.
That's such a you know, incredible story there. You know, all, kind of like you're, what you're saying, this whole idea of yes, you know, in, you know, nominated with, you know, the most powerful person at the time in the world, and then, but yeah, to be able to say, like, at a certain point, like, you know, don't forsake the role of women in the world, which is important. So my last, I guess, two questions of sorts is, we see a lot of issues with women's rights still in the world, unfortunately. I mean, obviously there's, you know, stuff that goes on here in the United States and in the West, but I'm thinking of, in particular, in Afghanistan, of course, as we've mentioned, it's very tough there now. In Iran, they've been really pushing for at least two years now, big activists, and the kind of, you know, with the Iranians around the world that are pushing for that. We see this in Syria. Tremendously. They've had a long 13 years there. It's not ended yet. We see it in Sudan. We see it obviously in the Palestine-Israel conflict in Yemen. We see it all in many of these parts of the world and in other parts as well, obviously in Ukraine and in Russia is ongoing. So there's unfortunately so much, so many challenges still in the world for generally for conflict, but sometimes some of it is specific for women's rights. So when you look at the, when you look at the globe now and you see, you know, what is the status of women in the world in some places where it in some ways feels like it's gone backwards in some ways. In other places, maybe it's, there's been some good progress, but what do you feel about that? You know, you've worked with this issue for a long time. You've talked to some of the most important, powerful people. What can you say to young women that are feeling very passionate or emboldened by this, or what can they do, or what would you, you know, what's the example you want to give there for women around the world?
Yeah, it's very difficult question, but it's very. good question, I would say. I think one, if you look at the conflict around us, and it's a very devastating conflicts going on in, around the world. But then it's all man-made. It's not female-made or woman-made. And it's very sad. It's very unfortunate. And the other point that I would like to mention is that how much they are using the militarization for revenge, and that is not justice. So we need to promote justice. Thirdly, I think, is that all these conflicts and insecurity put women in difficult situations everywhere. no matter how peaceful all the countries, but it's always sad for women, and it's always difficult for women. And my message to the young women around the globe is that we, as an important part of the humanity, we have to fight for our rights and for equality, not fighting with gun, not killing, not with violence, but we can use our civil disobedience to resist against these things. In countries which is democratic countries and they is free and fair election, I don't know if it's really free and fair election around the world, but still they have to use that tool and fight for them. And the other point that I would like to mention is that these rights are not guaranteed fully. It can be taken by politicians. And they have to be active in politics to not give the possibility and facilities for the men to take them back. So that is my advice to the young woman. We are not done yet. We are not fully equal in any country in this planet. They might be in some of the paper in some of the countries, but not fully
implemented. Yeah. I would agree with that. And finally, you know, what do you make about the future of your country, of Afghanistan? Where you know, what do you think, you know, could happen, or what outcome do you want to see? Where can things get better and more on track for Afghanistan?
I think the problem, denial of the problem in Afghanistan and ignoring Afghanistan is not the solution for everybody, for the international community. I think it will be the repetition of the same mistakes as they did in the 1990s. So they have to focus on Afghanistan or any other countries with the same problems, with conflict. Because that, we like it or not, it will reach everywhere. That is fact and it's already proved. The second point that I would like to mention is that we in Afghanistan, the people of Afghanistan, has to come together and work on equality and principles of inclusivity and equal rights. And I would like to see everyone to live with dignity and access to justice. I repeat that revenge is not justice. We have to promote human rights and human dignity, no matter which religion we practice, which language we speak. We have to promote the universality of human rights.
Yeah, I would fully agree. Well, I'll just say it's not every day that you can meet heroes for our race, but you certainly are a hero for many people, and you are such an inspiration for me, for many people. Your story, your life, what you advocate for is tremendous, and I'm there for you and supporting you as many people are, and for you to keep making that fight. Seema, this is such a lovely conversation. You have such a powerful spirit, and I'm very, very grateful for you taking the time to talk with me. And so it's a big, big, big thanks.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure. And thank you for your time and patience and support.
Of course.